This episode is brought to you by the Women's Network.
Embrace being an outsider, right? There's so many wonderful things about being an outsider. And because for so many years when I was younger, I so wanted to not be an outsider, right? I wanted to be one of the cool kids. I wanted to be the one who was on cheerleading. I wanted to be the one who was like the jock. I'm none of those things, right? And I so desperately wanted to be one of the people who, you know, and for a long time, even with when I was the non-technical patent attorney, I'm like, God, I wish I had a computer science degree. I wish I had this. And then somewhere along the way, I'm like, you know what? It's great that I didn't have any of that stuff. And so really embrace being an outsider and understand that actually it can be a benefit as well.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Redefining Ambition. I'm your host, Jamie Vinnick, founder and president of the Women's Network, the largest collegiate women's networking organization in the United States. I'm thrilled to introduce our next guest, the very inspiring Malin Yen. Malin is the founder and general partner of Operator Collective, a venture fund that has united operators, founders, and investors from diverse backgrounds under one umbrella. After failing to land clerkships and internships at law firms, Malin wound up accepting an unpaid internship at the SEC in the enforcement division, which later opened numerous doors for her and changed the trajectory of her career. After graduating from UC Berkeley School of Law, Malin worked her way up to becoming an expert in IP litigation and served as the vice president of worldwide intellectual property at Cisco. Along the way, she co-founded a nonprofit called CHIPS, that originally started as an informal dinner group, which connects women in tech, law, and policy, and has thousands of members around the world. She went on to scale and build Saster as COO and RPX Corporation as their chief business and product officer into massively successful companies before ultimately founding her own venture fund in 2018. In this episode, we speak about Malin's career path, her take on building a more inclusive venture ecosystem, mentorship, and embracing being an outsider. Hope you enjoyed the episode and make sure to follow us on Instagram at Redefining Ambition.
It is such a pleasure and an honor to have Malin on our podcast. Welcome to Redefining Ambition.
Thank you so much, Jamie. I'm so happy to be here.
So happy to have you. You have a really inspired career, and I was speaking to you about why I wanted to have you on and a little bit more about how your background has really played a huge hand in where your career has taken you. And it's certainly not a linear career. So I would love to start off by better understanding your background, your upbringing, where you grew up before heading off to Cal Poly, where you studied. But what did you think you wanted to do? What was some of the inspiring components of your upbringing that ultimately led you to that point?
Happy to do so. I grew up mostly in the Bay Area in San Jose, went to public school in San Jose. And I have to tell you, didn't really think about much about like what I wanted to do. I had parents who were immigrants who still don't really speak English. And it was literally about sort of walking myself to school, coming home, because both my parents worked, instead of like when I look at my kids and I look at all the kids today and how much they've achieved, even by a young age, I largely walked myself to school, right? Ate lunch, came home, and then basically watched TV. So I know like every single, like, you know, afternoon TV show there is. And also, you know, I was fortunate to have very supportive family always around me, but it was also one where we didn't have a lot of money. We were on a reduced and a free lunch program, which I was very grateful for, but it wasn't even really something that I thought about too much. And so from there, I guess I would say it was a very, very late bloomer because I think if you met me early on, even in high school, probably even in college, I don't think you would have thought that I would have done something that was entrepreneurial. I don't think that you would have thought that I really would have ever been comfortable actually even speaking in front of people too. And there's a few things that happened kind of along the way that I think allowed that to shift, which I'm happy to get into later. But early on, it was really, I would say, grew up a lot as an outsider and largely very happy being relatively invisible.
Mm-hmm. So you go off to college, and there, did anything shift in your mind, or were you there? Was the mentality, I will figure out what I'm interested in, get a job, try to find happiness, or were you at that point thinking beyond?
And I mean, I would say no. I actually was not a particularly deep thinker for a long time. Like I said, I was a late bloomer. I ended up applying and going to law school. But the reason I decided to do that was I did have a professor who was teaching business law, and I ended up taking that class. And I thought, wow, she has a really, really amazing lifestyle, which is she lived half the time in San Francisco. She lived half the time in San Luis Obispo, where I went to undergrad. And she was just super smart and super on top of things. And a very, probably one of the earliest, most powerful sort of women leaders that I had met. And I was like, you know, there's something incredibly sort of attractive about having a role model like that. And so I think that goes down to, even though I wasn't necessarily aware of it, didn't have, you know, when you can see someone who's doing something that looks like you could do it and you would want to do it that way, it can be incredibly inspiring. And so I don't even think I realized it at a deeper level, except like this reaction, which is like, wow, she's amazing. I would love to do something like what she's doing.
I completely agree with you. I studied finance because I had this amazing finance professor who actually came on the podcast who inspired me to study the discipline, but I would not have had probably that level of interest. And every other professor I had who taught finance was an older white man. So I completely agree with you.
Jamie, I was actually also a finance major in undergrad. So it's the same thing. We probably had almost the same professors. Except for this woman.
Yes. That's so funny. So before you headed off to law school, you took a gap year.
Yeah.
You traveled the world with $3,000. What was that like? And was this like a last hurrah before entering law school? I mean, a lot of people have epiphanies or these realizations and learning lessons. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah. Well, stepping back for a second, before, to give you some context, so I grew up with immigrant parents. We didn't have a lot of money. Where we would regularly go on vacation, I remember, is all piling into the Ford station wagon, driving down. I live in Northern California, driving down to Los Angeles and Anaheim, staying in the Ramada Inn across the street from Disneyland. And that was our vacation, which I loved. It was great. I remember the Ramada Inn had, like, you know, one of those curly pools. So it was really the highlight of I think, my childhood. But beyond that, and then when my sister went to college, my older sister went to college, she went to UCLA. And I remember, the first time and only time I'd ever been on a plane is when I went to go down to visit her in college when I was 16. So had never been on a plane or traveled anywhere. And so I had not been out of the country ever. I had never really, I think my parents might've driven us to Arizona once, right? Never been out of state, really. And I remember in college just hearing about all these stories about the people around me who, it's like when they're, you know, when they went to Europe, when they did this, when they went to Japan, and I'd never been anywhere. And so I decided that, okay, I'm going to take a gap year and I'm just going to travel because I've never even been on a plane. And so I saved up my money. I waited tables. I saved money. And I didn't really know how long I was going to be gone for. So I bought one-way tickets everywhere. And a little tip is, like, if you're traveling by yourself and you have one-way tickets and the customs people and the border control ask you, like, where you're going next and you tell them you don't know, pretty much you're going to get stopped and, like, searched. So I got stopped and searched a lot because, you know, it's like this little Asian, you know, 20-something year old saying, I have no ongoing ticket and, you know, and I don't know where I'm going. So that was character building too. But that was a lot because I had never really been on my own, right? I lived in a relatively sheltered family growing up, had never really been outside anywhere on my own. And so I traveled for a year by myself and was able to really learn how to blend in. Because even from just, and this was before there were a lot of cell phones too. I've like, my parents wouldn't hear from me for months. I still don't think they knew I was actually traveling for the entire time. I think they thought I was still at school or something. But you learn to be really observant, right, around you. You learn to observe people's cultures, observe how they interact so that you don't stand out like a sore thumb. And I think from an early age, always having been an outsider, and when you're an outsider, you do tend to observe and watch a lot. And for me, wanting to always be kind of more invisible when I was little allowed me to blend in these different countries. And so and I went through Europe and then I went through Asia. And then I came home at the end of the year. And so, and I also got odd jobs along the way. So the $3,000 lasted me, you know, for the year, because I could get a job nannying. I could get a job, you know, doing this or doing that here and there, and then met friendly people along the way. So that was, and I don't think it was like, I'm going to go travel because I'm going to go discover myself. It was like, I've never seen anything in the world. I've never even been on a plane except to Los Angeles, you know, which is like an hour flight. and that's it. And I just want to do this because I feel like there's a lot that I don't know, and certainly learned a lot that year.
So when people travel and immerse themselves in new cultures and countries, often they're thinking about, what do I want to be in the world? Or what do I want to do? Or what am I driven by? After experiencing what money could give me or what would allow me to do, it would open a greater sense of more autonomy, more freedom, more exploration. Did you ever think like, maybe I am more driven monetarily, or did that have an influence on you? Did it shape how you thought about what you thought you're going to be driven by and what your goals were?
Yeah, I think, again, it was a lot about observing and seeing how people lived and how they lived their lives and what was important to them. I think that did have an influence in what I ultimately wanted to do and have the ability to do. But I think on a larger level, you know, lots of times I do things because, you know, you're just compelled, and maybe you do things right that you're just compelled to do so. And you don't necessarily realize the significance of it until you're done. So I didn't even realize until I just did it was that it's not that common when you're, you know, 20 years old, right, to go travel around the world by yourself on $3,000. And what that teaches you is to be incredibly, incredibly self-sufficient, and to also be aware of how do you make sure that you take care of yourself. Because, you know, there were some situations where I look back, I'm like, okay, that was kind of sketchy as like a young woman by herself traveling, right, in the, you know, in the southern parts on the of certain countries on the train, you know, 24 hours where you end up, you know, just by yourself. But you know, I think it does just teach you really a lot of self-sufficiency, which is that there's no one to depend on but yourself. And these were not in the days of cell phones. No one knew where I was, except when I would occasionally call my parents, or I would literally like write a letter home, right? Email didn't really, it wasn't quite pervasive at the time.
Wow. So you go off to law school, you study at UC Berkeley. Did you ever have the feeling, some people do, some people don't, like, I didn't deserve to be there, or everyone around me seems so much smarter than I am, and I'm trying to keep up, and it's been difficult? And tracing those thoughts back to where you are today, if you did have those thoughts at the time, do they continue to linger?
Yeah. So what actually happened is I applied. So I didn't decide I wanted to apply to law school until kind of later in my undergrad. So I got good grades, but not like phenomenal grades. And then I took the LSAT, got a decent score on the LSAT. But and so I actually went to a different law school first. And when I was at that law school, I realized that that I actually wanted to go to Berkeley for a number of reasons. And so I studied really hard, right, and got really good grades. I think I was like number one in the class, and then ended up, which is actually, I mean, I got to tell you, it was actually the first time I'd ever been number one in my class. You know, again, I got good grades, I got decent grades, but I was not the, you know, the type of person who was the number one in the class type of person. And then ended up applying and making it to Berkeley. And what's interesting is, yeah, I felt a little intimidated at first, right? Because people come from all these credentials and they have all these backgrounds, and you think, well, I don't. And okay, now that I'm in the big leagues, right, with some of these folks, can I compete? But I also, I think, very quickly found that to be very comfortable also. Like, I felt like I was comfortable and I had kind of found my people. And Berkeley's a unique school, right, in terms of it's just in terms of the culture there. And I grew up in the Bay Area too, so I very much felt like my people. And so certainly there were times where I felt like, wow, these people have gone to all these Ivy League schools. They've done this. They've had access to this. And I felt like I didn't. And in fact, that led to, you know, the series, like the first of a number of sort of failures on my part that are deep, deep learnings or rejections. So when you're in law school, you, after your first year summer, your second year summer, you interview on campus and you want to find, and what they do is just, you know, you get your 2L job, and your 2L job, second year law school job, is the one that dictates where you're going to end up oftentimes after graduation. And so I did a number of interviews. So I was just happy to get to Berkeley, right? Like, I'm like, oh, I've made it. I've made it to Berkeley. But that's not enough, actually. Everyone else was doing all these other extraordinary things. And I was just happy to be there, frankly. And so I interviewed, and it was still tough because at the time, like, you know, there was another sort of, the recession had not come out, and like the lawyers always kind of get hit, and then it takes a little bit while for the law firms to rehire again. And I decided I wanted to stay in the Bay Area, and it was also very hard to find a job in the Bay Area. So I interviewed for a 2L job, did a number of interviews. And in retrospect, when I think about the questions that they asked me, because I do remember, they're like burned into my memory, because again, sometimes these failures stay with you forever. And I think about the answers I give, I'm like, no wonder they didn't hire me. Like, I wouldn't have hired me given those answers. And so I interviewed and I didn't get an offer. And so all of my friends got offers at like really phenomenal school, like firms, and I got nothing. And so from the on-campus interview, so, which is very humbling, right? And it's like, okay. But I also didn't have enough self-awareness or anyone to help me at the time see why I didn't get an offer, right? When I think about it now, I know exactly why I didn't get an offer and how I responded to things and how I approached things. But at the time I didn't know, because I just didn't have anyone like that. Right. So I didn't get an offer, and I was like, okay, great. Like, what am I going to do now? And so I was able to get, I actually ended up applying for like any sort of random like law clerk job that I could get, and ended up getting an offer from the SEC for the summer in the enforcement division. And it was an unpaid internship. And then I also got one with a small immigration law firm, and I didn't want to do immigration, but it was paid. And again, I didn't have a lot of money. I was on loans. My parents didn't have money, and I wanted, and so it was very tempting to take the paid job, but I didn't, right? I ended up taking the unpaid job, and I think it was one of the best decisions I'd ever made.
Yeah. Elaborate on that. How did it open more doors for you? Why was it one of the best decisions you've made? That one decision right there, when all of your friends were beginning to see these lucrative checks come in at prestigious firms, here you were working unpaid with the government. And yet it was a transformative experience.
Yeah. So, and I don't think I knew this at the time, but sometimes you just want to trust your gut. Now in retrospect, again, you look back and it's like, well, of course that was the right decision. But at the time when you're facing this, you know, do I take this paid job for money or do I go this path? But why it made it transformative is if I had taken the immigration job, one, it was not an area I wanted to go into. Two, the lawyer who was hiring, and it was a small firm, just needed help, which was great. There's nothing wrong with that. That's why you hire people. But on the other side, there were two, and actually they were both Asian, two senior attorneys at the SEC who had interviewed me and took an interest in me. Like, okay, like, we want you to come here. This is what you're going to learn. And they both took me under their wing. And so I don't think back then, you know, the idea about like mentorship and like, you know, underrepresented backgrounds, it was not top of mind to anyone. You just sort of existed back then. And maybe you knew it was there, but it wasn't conscious at any level. And so I didn't even realize, it's like, wow, I have the ability to work with two amazing Asian, like, women attorneys, of which there aren't that many of them, you know, who are in these positions. It didn't really occur to me somewhere, but in my gut, I was like, you know what, I'm really comfortable and I really like these women. And so I'm going to take this unpaid job. And they did, they took me under their wing. And the thing is when people take you under their wing and they want you to succeed and they see something in you that maybe you don't even see in yourself, that makes all the difference in the world in terms of your ability to succeed. It's that confirmation bias, right? If you meet someone, and I mean, there's studies how different races or ethnicities get confirmation bias, positive or negative, right? It's like, if someone comes in and be like, oh my God, Jamie, you're amazing. Like, I want you to come work here. And when you eventually screw up, because everyone's going to screw up, especially when you're early, they're not going to be like, see, you know, we knew she was going to fail. It's like, Jamie, that was a great learning lesson, right? Let's do this. And so it wasn't conscious, but this is what they did, which is that they believed that I would be great. And so they wanted me to be great, which means that when I learned quickly. And when I made mistakes, it wasn't like, oh, see, you couldn't do this, or we shouldn't have hired you. And then from there, they actually were the ones that enabled me to get my, and I was, because I was like, I'm never going to get a job after law school because everyone gets teed up from the second year. But they actually paved my way to get that job after law school because it was a law firm that both of them used to be at.
Wow. You know that. What a great story. But you had mentioned a little bit earlier in this conversation that you were pretty invisible. And was that the first moment where you felt seen and heard?
Yeah, I actually do think so. It was probably one of the earliest moments where it's like someone sees something in me. And then when I went to the firm, because of course they had, you know, there's studies that show like when a woman goes up to give a speech versus when a male goes up to give a speech, depending on how you introduce that woman or that male depends on how well that talk is received, right? So if you introduce the woman by saying, this is Jamie, she's the most incredible Nobel PhD, you know, prize winner, she's well, blah, 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 then people will be like, oh yeah, she's great. And if we just like, hey, this is Jamie, she's going to talk to you. Like you actually just, I mean, the studies do show you don't actually get the same response. And so what that set me up for, what I realize now that they did was that they was like, not only do you need to hire her, she's awesome. And so when the people I went to and started working with there, they were ready to say, okay, like she's going to be great and we're going to help her. And so, cause I certainly made a lot of mistakes. Like I remember like one of the first briefs I wrote and then we got the response back from the other side and they just were like, it was just like devastating to my brief. And I remember like literally like, I don't cry very much, but I was literally like crying down the hallway and the partner's like chasing after me going, it's okay. I'm like, oh my God, I failed. And that was a great learning for me because it was a really painful response to the brief. But when you feel like you're in a safe place, when you feel like people want you to succeed and they want you to learn, it makes all the difference in terms of your ability to believe in yourself. Because at the time I didn't think I was anything special. And I think everyone does have something special about them, but you need to, you know, when someone else can see that, you know what, you have the ability to succeed and to grow and to be a leader, that really makes you believe in yourself.
Yes, absolutely. What a great story, by the way. Thank you for sharing that. There is today more conversation than perhaps there was even a couple of years ago, nonetheless, 10, 20 years ago, about the importance of mentorship and also sponsorship. How, just in hearing the impact it's made on your life, how can more young people, young women, women of color, people of color, actively seek mentorship without feeling like it is a burden for a lot of people who can sponsor them in the workplace or mentor them, given the impact it has made on your life?
Yeah. So what I would say is it needs to be natural. You can be deliberate, but it needs to be natural. Like I've given talks before where someone will come up to me afterwards that I've never met before and just say, oh, that was a great talk. Will you be my mentor?
Oh.
Yeah. And it's like, no, my job is not to mentor the world for, you know, I have to, you know, I have my own job. I have my own family. I have my own things to do. And so it has to be more natural. And then I've also had situations where it's like, okay, well, for some people I don't naturally work with to be like, oh, let's have coffee or lunch or whatever, like, and I'll do that. And then after about the first coffee, if you don't figure out something to work on together, you kind of run out of things to say. I mean, I got to tell you, it's like, okay, your vacation, what do you do? Blah, blah, blah. And once you're done with that, that's it. But the thing is if you then ask me for a recommendation for you to, or a referral on something, I cannot speak to any of your abilities beyond the fact that like, she was nice to have coffee with. And so to mentorship, you know, in the mentor-mentee relationships can be incredibly rewarding both ways. But in order for those to be truly meaningful, where someone could actually help you, you also need to be helping them. And so how do you find something that's relevant to what they're doing that it gives you an ability to work on something. And it doesn't have to be in the work context. It could be something outside of work. For me, I had a nonprofit. So I ended up bringing a lot of these young women and some men actually too, into this nonprofit, and we could work on things. And then I could see them in action and interact. And so when it came time to recommend them, I'm like, I worked with her on this. She is great on, you know, on why, and I would hire her in an instant. Otherwise, what could I possibly say? Because, you know, no one's going to recommend anyone else if their credibility is on the line, if they don't have any basis for that. And so think about what might be important to the person that you want to be spending time with. How can you help them given what you're working on, and given your ability? Is it promoting them? You know, is inviting them to speak on a podcast? Is it looking to make intros? Is it, if you have a big social media presence, maybe it's just retweeting, right? And promoting what they're doing. The mentor relationship has to develop naturally, and find it a way to make it natural to collaborate on something that ties you together and gives the relationship meaning. And then it's going to be incredibly rewarding on both sides. And that's when it works best.
That is amazing practical advice. And we have had a lot of guests who have come on the podcast who have also shared something similar about someone approaching them saying, can you be my mentor? And it's just not how you would approach a situation like that. No one would say, yes, I'll be your mentor. I don't know anything about you. I don't know where you're from. I don't know what your skills are. I don't know what your interests are, but sure. And I love how you just touched on how a young person can provide value to someone who is more powerful, more seasoned, more experienced, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the ways in which they think it is. So no, that was great that you touched on that. I want to get into how you go from patent law, something that is very niche, very specific, very technical, to venture capital and to business. And what was the turning point that enabled you to bridge the gap between these two intersections? How were you able to transition from this particular area of law into business, which I'm sure has more correlations and intersections than one would anticipate?
Yeah, I am still the only former IP attorney patent specialist that I've ever met who then went on to raise venture fund. It's not that common. And in fact, if you wanted to chart your path, you would never start where I started and end up where you was just, that definitely was not deliberate. So I've always done things that are a little bit out of the ordinary, where I don't quite have the right background for that, and just sort of do it. And then, you know, occasionally have those feelings of imposter syndrome. And then I have someone who believes in me to be like, no, this is why you're doing it. So actually I'll step back for a second. So I started out as a litigator, did patent litigation, and then I moved into transactional law. And then I got a job at Cisco working for my old boss from the law firm, who actually was working in the patent area. And so I was working in patent litigation. He was a patent specialist. So he was on the technical side, I was on the litigation side, and we would work together because we had our offices next to each other. And so when he finally had the budget to hire his first attorney, he and I were talking, and he was like, well, why don't you come work here? I said, that would be great, because I thought he was brilliant. And he was another one where he just, you know, I knew he believed in me, and he was just someone I know I could learn a lot about, even though I didn't work directly for him. We worked in collaboration. But there was a moment of panic too, because I was going to be the first patent counsel at Cisco, working for the VP of Worldwide Intellectual Property. And partway through, like right before I was going to start, I'm like, oh my God, I don't even have a technical degree, and I'm not a member of the patent bar. And which is kind of unheard of, to have neither one of those things and to be the first patent hire, IP hire. And we joke about it because my boss at the time, I was like, this is now 100% of my job. Like I could kind of, I mean, I'm technical in terms of I can pick things up. I'm like, but now this is 100% of my job as opposed to just a sliver of my job. And so I sort of panicked, didn't say anything to him. And then later we compared notes because he sort of panicked, he said. And then his wife, who had known me too through the Cisco days, was like, stop it, right? It's like, look at all the things that she does have, and like, she will be able to do this part. Anyway, it ended up being a very successful relationship and career, because then when he retired, I took over as vice president of worldwide IP. So I think one piece of advice too is like, sometimes don't overthink things, because if I had overthought that, I probably never would have interviewed or taken that job in the first place, because I've been like, I don't have the background. I mean, in no way, shape, or form did I actually have the background for this. I had aspects of things that I could do, but actually not the core thing, if you look at the job from the traditional way. And so one of the things after he got comfortable, I mean, he only had that slight moment of panic too. But what he would say to me is like, one of the reasons why you're so good at your job is because you think outside the box. And inside, I would say to myself, it's actually because I don't know enough to know what the box is. but I also think that that's a benefit. When you aren't confined with how things are always done, then you won't be limited by it. It doesn't mean you can know nothing about, like, you know, patents and law or whatever it is, but sometimes you will question things because you have a fresh eye, as opposed to saying, oh, well, that's how it's been done for 100 years. That's why we have to do it that way. And so that was sort of the beginning of always not having the right background, but somehow barreling forward anyway. And then realizing, it took me probably 20 years to realize that that's actually an advantage when you can be not too ingrained in something, so that you can think creatively and put something together in a way that you just never would if you had been in the industry for 20 years.
Wow. You also touched on the power of a network and the power of community. And you co-founded this incredible nonprofit, CHIPS, and served as CEO, board director. I would love for you to also share more about what CHIPS is, but more specifically, the power of community. And your career, certainly CHIPS has been really rooted in what community means, the importance of it, the importance of having a network, and how you've been able to leverage and also utilize the network that you've been able to rely on and also advancing your career.
Yeah, so CHIPS stands for Chiefs and IP, or affectionately Chicks and IP, because it was mostly women. And so it started out because when I was head of IP, there were very few women in that position because, but for me, you usually have a technical degree and then you work your way up. And so, you know, it just keeps getting smaller and smaller. And so when I was promoted to head of IP at Cisco, there were so few women in that position that there was actually a front page story in the legal press about my getting the position. And in that story, the reporter asked me as she was interviewing me, like, how many other women have this position? And there were 6 others at the time. That's it. And what I realized from that is that it was sort of like, oh, maybe this person and this person. And I only knew like maybe 1 or 2 of them and very passing. It's like, there's so few of us. Like, we need to know each other at a very minimum. Like, why don't we know each other? It's just that you're so heads down working all the time, right? It's like, it doesn't even occur. Again, people are not as aware as they are now, that it wasn't until she asked me that I didn't even register. Like, there aren't very many women who are in this position. And so once I realized that, I said, well, we should know each other. And so we actually started out as a women's dinner group and we just got together. It's like, because we just need to know each other. And then we started to talk about the common themes, which is like, yeah, I'm getting sick of being pitched by like teams. Again, technical people pitching us. So it tends to be a lot of men. In fact, almost all men. And so from there, it ended up, you know, taking on a life of its own and becoming, and we ended up incorporating as a nonprofit after years of sort of existing. And again, we didn't think about things too much. What happened was one of my co-founders said, she had just come from the East Coast and said, you know what we have out here is actually unique. The people on the East Coast don't have it. Let's have a cocktail party so we can meet some of our East Coast folks. And so we said, yeah, that sounds great. And then it was like, oh, we have all these people. Like, we should have a panel. I was like, great. And then we're like, you know what? There's so many people who want to come. Let's just have a conference. And like, none of us had even planned a big wedding. So we had no clue. And so I was like, I was literally like, how hard is it? You just get a hotel and you order the food. Like, what? I mean, and that's how much thought went into it. And so another of us like called a hotel. It's like, oh, I've been to this hotel and in DC, they have a nice spa. Let's do it there. So we called and they're like, they have a space in 4 weeks. We're like, oh, that's great. And so we literally like booked it in 4 weeks and we didn't have a bank account. We actually weren't even incorporated yet and decided to just do it because we just didn't know how much work it was going to be. We had like law firms signing for us and we got incorporated quickly. And anyway, it literally almost killed us because we actually didn't realize how much time and we all had our day jobs on top of it. And none of us are good at planning things. But from there, it jump-started us into saying, okay, now we're a nonprofit. We're onto something here that these women need, and we wanted to do it too. And so that was my first community. And again, just sort of stumbled into it. But from there, every other community, and Operator Collective is my fourth company startup with a strong community aspect, but really learned about the power of community and how do you build community? You can't build community. I mean, you have an amazing community here. You can't build by going too broad to start with, right? Just like you started with a small niche. And this is the same way with any startup and any product you build, anything that you launched, you start with that initial niche, you get traction, and then you expand, right? Can you expand this platform? And so now, like when I built the Operator Collective community, you know, it was pretty successful right out of the box pretty quickly because I'd done this four times already. But the first time, right, it was 15 years. Before I finally stepped off the board and turned it over to like the next generation who's like doing phenomenal things with it. And, of just like learning and saying like, how do people interact? What people are there? What is value? How do you make this deeply sort of personal, but how do you also, you know, turn this into something that's more than just fun to be at, but right, something where you're getting something out of it as much as you're giving to it.
What are the members of now this of CHIPS express in the need? You had touched on there's such a need for this, for people to gather, for people to connect, people to have access to a network. And clearly it was resonating. I mean, you don't just turn out thousands of people, and now it's at what, 10,000?
Yeah. And 22 chapters around the world. So I think it was, so there were so few women in the patent field. And so partly it was just craving, not just being surrounded by, you know, homogenous, you know, individuals every day and being surrounded by people like you. And the thing is we never made it about, let's talk about work-life balance. Let's talk about being a woman in the field. We made it always about like, what does it take to be the best, right? Chief IP counsel. What if I want to do this? How do I do this? It was always substantive. Some of it was like hardcore law, like should, you know, Java be protected by copyright, you know, when we had, which occasionally did a copyright type thing. And also like, okay, how do you make yourself a better public speaker? So it was things about that, as opposed to like talking about being a woman in tech. But what also happened from there that led to eventually a confluence of events that led to Operator Collective is one thing was very frustrating to me about CHIPS, because I thought that if we just brought a bunch of these women together in the room, and so they're mostly lawyers, right? And so the lawyers in this room were law firm lawyers, government lawyers, and then in-house corporate lawyers, like the head of, you know, IP at Apple, who was one of my co-founders. And so we, the in-house lawyers, controlled a lot of legal spend. And we were trying to figure out, okay, how can I direct more of that to phenomenal lawyers who are from diverse backgrounds, as opposed to just the dominant homogenous group. And so I thought when we did this, it's like, look, as long as we can get everyone, people just don't know each other. If they get to know each other, then business will naturally happen. And so I was like, okay, and everyone knows each other. Everyone loved each other. Everyone was like, oh my God, they went on vacation together. We swapped maternity clothes. We, you know, did all kinds of things, and business wasn't really happening. And I was like, what is going on with this? And so I actually interviewed and talked to a lot of people on both sides, like what's going on when you're trying to pitch for, it wasn't that women weren't asking. Some women weren't asking, some women were asking. But when the women were asking and they were trying to turn these relationships into business, it wasn't being received very well. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what is going on? Because what was bugging me too, and I am going to generalize here, is that I was observing, and again, right, I'm always watching, and always, because I'm always feeling like an outsider, is always watching. And I would observe that these, and also from being, you know, the daughter of immigrant parents who didn't really have a lot of exposure to the way sort of normal Western culture interacts, like always joke, but it's sort of true. I didn't really learn to talk to adults till I was like 30, was like the ease at which Westerners would go in between, like, hey, be like, hey, Jamie, how's it going? Let's have lunch. And then walk away. Like my parents were all like, you can't trust Westerners. Like they say, let's go to lunch, and they never follow up. Right. So these things where it's like, I didn't learn these social norms, even though I was born in this country. So I would watch these mostly men who would be friends, and inevitably all these men would turn their friendships into some sort of money-making generating deals. Like the general counsel of Cisco, you know, was male and learned a ton from him, but like his buddies and these people he knew, they would always end up pitching for business. And sometimes we would give it to them. And so I was like, okay, but I've seen that the women, it wasn't as natural to be like, okay, we're friends. So now we're going to do revenue generating business together. So I interviewed a ton of people, men and women, to understand like what's going on here. And so I ended up writing this piece that, and I actually sat on it for a year after I wrote it, because I wasn't sure how well it was going to go over, because it was about like how women interact versus men interact and what's holding women back from being able to do this. If you Google it, it's August of 2018. I sent it to Fortune and they're like, okay, we're going to publish it. I didn't realize how quickly they were going to publish it. Remember, I was like driving on vacation with my kids and they're like, okay, we just published it. And I was like, oh shoot. And I looked at it, I'm like, oh my God, because the title that they put on it, they didn't ask me first. They just did it. I'm actually glad they did it now. But at the time I'm like, oh no. The title they put is like how women's friendships get in the way of business. Right. And I was like, oh my God, I'm just going to be blasted for this. Because again, I like to be invisible. I don't like to be out there. I'm not someone who likes controversy, right? Or to be a part of it. But the piece was about what I was just saying, which is like, what was different about how women tend to like to socialize and how men tend to socialize and the deeply personal relationships that women have versus men, which tend to be transactional and superficial, apparently they're almost their entire 25-year friendship. And what was holding people back. And then also I offered some suggestions on how do you scaffold to do that. And it ended up being, I didn't actually hear any negative feedback despite that title. It went pretty viral and a lot of people reached out to me and people were having book group discussions about it and it went all over the place. But I was like, okay, we have to do something about this because the thing is like the business world is set up such that it caters to the way that the typical dominant homogenous group likes to do business, which is, you know, white males. And it's not done in a way that people like me and us might like to do it. So I'm like, instead of telling the women, you just need to act like a man, it doesn't work. Because like there's studies that show too, like when people say, oh, the pay equity, because women aren't negotiating for their pay. You know what? When a woman negotiates for their pay, it's not taken as well, right? So she gets penalized for it. So there are reasons why women don't negotiate or haven't in the past. Again, this was you know, before there's a lot of awareness of this too. So it wasn't that, okay, women, you just need to act like the men. Because one, I don't want to act like a man. And two, you can't just act like a man because you don't get the same response. And so as a result of this, I was like, I want to find a way, fast forward to a number of steps too, when I was putting together Operator Collective, which is we're not just going to tell the operators who happen to be women, who happen to be people of color, who want to engage in venture to just say, oh, go find a way to engage in venture. I'm like, we're going to build something that's so compelling that venture is going to come to us. And so that we're going to make the venture world adapt to our busy lives and also how we like to spend our time, as opposed to saying you need to bring yourself to the rigid construct of how venture operates today. So that piece with the controversial title, which probably helped to go viral, led to a lot of discussions, including some of the people who are LPs in the fund. Michelle Zaitlin, who's the COO and president and co-founder of Cloudflare, she tweeted it. And that's how we actually ended up meeting and getting together. Because she's like, I read this article and she's a good friend. She was at my house a couple of days ago as we had one of our gatherings. And so that piece, again, and for those of you who, if any of you guys are out there like me, who just don't really like to be in the spotlight, don't really like to put yourself out there or really say anything controversial, you know, it is good to do that. Because had they not put that piece with that title that I would have never approved, I don't know that it would have gone as viral. And I don't know if it would have led to all these discussions that led to these relationships that led to my being able to eventually be in this position to put together the fund. And also my being so fixated on, we're going to change the system, right? We can't just tell all the women and people of color and the immigrants and the people who don't speak English and the introverts to say, you have to act like the dominant homogenous extroverted group, because I don't want the world to be like that. And that should not be what success is. I want to create a new normal of saying you can be successful and not be out there bragging about yourself all the time. It's not like, oh, because women are told all the time too, like you need to go create your own brand. You need to go do this. You need to do that. But you know what? When you're out there trying to create your brand in the way that they say you should do it, which is tweet about yourself, promote self, you get blasted for it. Oh, she's not a team player. She's in it only for herself. And so you get this advice that young women are, I was told a million times, like go promote your brand. And I never did it because I was like, ew, I don't want to do that. And I'm glad I did it, because if you do, you get blasted on the other end. And so I think the recognition that we are treated differently because of our gender, our color of our skin, right? And our backgrounds And knowing that you can't just say, well, the world should just treat us all the same. The world does not treat us the same. The world does not see us the same. So understanding that, how do we start to slowly change the system so that we don't just have to try to conform to this one, you know, persona that everyone should be, of which we can't even be successful when we try to be that persona anyway.
That was so powerful. Yes. I'm sure people who are listening to this right now at this point are moved the way I am. That was incredibly powerful to share. And just to kind of set the stage here for those of you listening who are not fully aware of the stats in VC, venture capital, 85% of venture capitalists are men.
And it's actually higher when you look at the enterprise, which is where the B2B stuff, and you take out the consumer. So yeah, you're all in the right ballpark there.
The venture capitalists have a lot of power. And when the people who are making decisions don't look like a lot of the people who are trying to raise funds, there's an issue. There's a disconnect. How do you think, and this is a very broad question, do you think the industry is going to begin to change to see more women, not just entering, but also successfully raising funds? We know that women founded funds and companies outperform their male counterparts. I think it's by like 151% is the exact stat, I believe. How do you see the industry kind of shifting and becoming a little bit more inclusive?
Yeah. So to share a few other stats with you. So it's mostly male, it's mostly white. And so when the people who are mostly male and mostly white control the same dollars, right? Necessarily the types of people that they're funding, when you can have pattern recognition, it seems to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So when Lyft went public in the New York Times digital edition, there was this graphic that said the same group of PayPal founders are getting rich again and again. And it just sort of shifted with the little dots of like who's who. It's like they did this and they did this company. And so Operator Collective was always about how do you expand wealth creation? It was not about creating a separate ecosystem of just women and people of color funding women and people of color. It is about how do we actually make it natural for these women and people of color to intersect with this dominant homogenous group of largely white men who are controlling all the power and money right now. Because most of them actually are not saying, let's keep out the women and people of color. They just don't know us, right? And we don't hang out with them. So as you said, forced diversity doesn't work. How do you make it natural to come together? Because you tend to know people like you. There's a study that shows not only is it like over 90%, right, male, 40% of them, over 40% went to Stanford or Harvard, right? So if you think about that, it's that same ecosystem again. Yeah, look, we fund people who went to Stanford and Harvard, but we also fund people who don't. So it is about how do you create the natural overlap of networks that don't typically intersect? And for me, it wasn't about like, and I'd done a nonprofit. It wasn't about like, we need to be doing this. And nonprofits are great, by the way, and I'm a big fan, but there's a limit to what they can do. I'm like, we have to financially align incentives so that what we are offering as Operator Collective is like our investor base, our what's called limited partner base, badass operators, meaning the people who have built and scaled up companies that you've heard of like Stripe and Salesforce. And the people who have done that are the people that VCs and founders want access to. And I'm like, if I can put that together, then they will come to us and bring us deals because they know that they're not dumb, right? They just don't know people like us. And even when I started this fund back in like 2018, 2019, like people didn't know what an operator was. We kind of coined the term and said an operator is someone who has built, scales, and runs companies. And we literally had to define it. So I knew if we built this, because they know this is what you need, as soon as a startup gets any traction at all, that we would be able to bring, we would have something where they would come to us for deals. And then the reason why I truly do this, because I am a builder of companies, didn't want to just be an investor, although I love investing, was that of our LP base, who tend to be old, rich, white males, we have 90% women, 40% people of color, which is unheard of. But it also goes back to, that's my network, right? Those are the people that was very natural. Like if I was a white male trying to do this, yeah, I could be successful. But like, I am like prototypical of the people that we brought in as LPs. Heads down, you've never heard of me. I've been in the background working, you know, giving 150% to my day job, because frankly, women and people of color don't get the benefit of the doubt, right? We have to prove it before we get it. We have to earn it before we can get that promotion. It's not like, oh, yeah, you look like someone who's done it, so we're just going to give it to you. And so what's left goes to like our friends and family, as opposed to going to go figure out how to do venture. So I knew a lot of people like me who happen to be women, happen to be people of color, brought them into the fund. And it works because we built a product that's so compelling that people come to us. And that's what you need to do, as opposed to forcing yourself on anyone. It's like we did something and it's extraordinary. We have amazing people that no one had even heard of. But once you dig below the surface of the people who aren't sitting there tweeting to each other all day, you're like, wow, these are the people who actually know their shit, Right. And they can help make my company successful. And founders and VCs, no matter what group you're with, the dominant homogenous group or otherwise, they're not dumb. Right? They know how hard it is. And we know how hard it is to build up these companies. So that's a little bit how all of this kind of ended up coming together, which is being an outsider, taking a different approach to say, why do the limited partners just need to be old, rich family offices or institutions? Why can't we bring these individuals? Why can't we create a sliding scale where you can make the access point, you know, a five-figure number as opposed to a, you know, a mid six-figure number? And a lot of people, when I did this, were like, you'll never make a fund like that. And I was like, you know what, but I'm going to do it because otherwise I wouldn't want to do a fund. And so this is the only way I want to do it. And I believe we can make a difference. And, you know, we're a few years in now. And again, nothing's liquid because, you know, you have to have a liquidity event, and especially enterprise companies take a while, but, you know, it's tracking to basically outperform most, you know, first-time funds. Again, fingers crossed, because it's been a good time to be an enterprise software investor, but it's working and it's awesome. But also at the same time, the only reason this is working is because so many people believed in this idea, believe that I could, you know, be a part of leading and doing this idea. And if that wasn't the case, this would have never happened because I do not have the background to have raised a venture fund. I do not have the background to have been doing this, but so many people. And so that's the final thing I think I'll leave you with is my kids. I have two kids, and they asked me once when they were a little bit younger, it's like, why do you spend so much time helping people? I was like, do you know how many people help me? I can't not help other people because so many people help me along the way. And that's what we do to give back.
We always ask this question. If you could leave our listeners with one lasting piece of advice, what would that be?
Embrace being an outsider, right? There's so many wonderful things about being an outsider. And because for so many years when I was younger, I so wanted to not be an outsider, right? I wanted to be one of the cool kids. I wanted to be the one who was on cheerleading. I wanted to be the one who was like the jock. I'm none of those things, right? And I so desperately wanted to be one of the people who, you know, and for a long time, even with when I was the non-technical patent attorney, I'm like, God, I wish I had a computer science degree. I wish I had this. And then somewhere along the way, I'm like, you know what? It's great that I didn't have any of that stuff. And so really embrace being an outsider and understand that actually it can be a benefit as well.
Thank you so much for coming on Redefining Ambition.
Jamie, thank you so much. It was so great to talk to you, and I'm in awe of what you created. Congratulations, having built communities. I know it's not easy.
Thanks so much for listening to an episode of Redefining Ambition. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe, rate us, tell your friends, and if there's anyone you think we should have on our show, let me know. Join me next Tuesday for a brand new episode of Redefining Ambition. We'll see you all then. Take care, everyone.